Thank you. My title is actually inspired by a kind of similar title that my collaborator Ray Sawyer used in giving a similar talk. His title was something like From Neutrino Oscillations to Quantum Computation, : An Inevitable Journey Based Loosely on the Odyssey, or something like that. Well, I couldn't top that, but I did take some inspiration from his title. As a subtitle, The Confessions of a Particle Physicist. This is not really a particle physics talk, although the material that I'm going to discuss grew out of our work on neutrino oscillation cosmology, the dynamics of neutrino oscillations in a collisional environment in the early universe. And I will be discussing the relevance of this to the neutrino side of the story as I go through. And in fact, some of the things I'll be talking about were raised during Yvonne Wong's seminar here, The Role of Collisions in Active-Active Oscillations Prior to Big Bang Nuclear Synthesis. But for the most part, this will be a general talk on fundamentals of quantum mechanics and decoherence. Okay, I have a number of acknowledgments. Started working on neutrino cosmology in the mid-90s, and I'd just like to acknowledge various colleagues from Melbourne and from Rome. And then in more recent years with my former students, Nicole Bell and Yvonne Wong, we teamed up with Ray Sawyer here to work on neutrino cosmology, but also taking what we learned in neutrino cosmology beyond that field in itself, and looking at things like quantum information theory and more general quantum mechanical problems. This talk will be based on a particular paper by Nicole, Ray, and myself that has appeared in Physical Review A, and you can also get it at the Virtual Journal of Quantum Information. Okay, the structure of my talk is as follows. The first half of this talk will be rather pedagogical, an introduction to reduced density matrices, decoherence. I'll talk about the measurement problem in the first section. In the second section, I'll say a few words about the quantum to classical transition and what decoherence has to do with it. This is not my work. I'll just be presenting some stuff from other people. In part three, I'm going to review something called the quantum Zeno effect. And this is the freezing of the evolution of a quantum system. It is of relevance for active sterile neutrino oscillation cosmology, which is how I came to learn about it. But of course, it is a reasonably famous phenomenon discussed in a wide variety of areas. In section four, I'm going to go to the heart of the new stuff I want to present, which is in our PRA paper. We'll call it Zeno Unbound for the purposes of today's talk. And it's a form of mode synchronization which is induced through interactions between the system, the oscillators, and an environment. And this will be an interesting contrast to the mode synchronization which Yvonne Wong and Alex Friedland spoke about. That one was induced by nonlinear effects in a completely coherent way through the matter effect and having neutrinos in the background. This is something different. This is synchronization induced by connection to a thermal bath. And then I'll conclude. Okay, so let me begin the pedagogical first half of my talk. So first of all, it is a trivial observation to say that all systems are open systems. They are interacting with the rest of the universe, other degrees of freedom, a thermal bath, whatever it is, some sort of environment. This is a trivial statement. Of course, the universe as a whole is by definition closed, but the systems that we deal with and study are open. Now, it turns out that this trivial observation has very important consequences for the quantum dynamics of systems. And this is because of the peculiarly quantum mechanical phenomenon or property of entanglement. A system which is open and interacting with other systems or an environment becomes entangled with the states of those systems, and therefore you have to treat the dynamics of that system itself taking all of that into account. And this leads you away from solving the Schrodinger equation to looking at quantum dynamics in a little bit more general way.
So because of entanglement, the openness of systems has very important implications for quantum dynamics. And this field is now burgeoning because of the interest in recent years since the mid-90s in quantum computing technology and quantum information theory. And it has been looked at over the years by Jim Hartle, amongst other people, in a variety of contexts. But it's really coming into its own, I think, now as a kind of a mature field. So I'd just like to point out a couple of statements about quantum mechanics and what people at various stages have found troubling about it. So one of the issues with quantum mechanics is the linearity of the Schrödinger equation and the superposition principle which that implies. And apparently, if you take that seriously and start applying it to macroscopic objects should have an underlying quantum description, then apparently you get yourself into a paradoxical situation, a situation you all know about, dramatized by the Schrödinger cat paradox. Now, the Schrödinger cat paradox arises because of this property of quantum mechanics linearity. Another peculiar property of quantum mechanics is entanglement. And I think it's interesting that these two things combine to basically make quantum mechanics less unreasonable. So let me go through that. So linearity apparently implies the cat problem, and this worries certain people. They look unhappy about what quantum mechanics is apparently saying about the world. It doesn't seem to accord with our experience of the world, where macroscopic superpositions are not readily observed. However, the trivial statement that we have a many-state universe, when combined with linearity, using tensor products in Hilbert space and so on, leads to the phenomenon or the property of entanglement. This is also was considered a troubling property of quantum mechanics, particularly and famously by Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, and the quantum correlations which entanglement describes have been called spooky action at a distance and something perhaps to be worried about. But what I'm going to discuss in these pedagogical opening remarks is that entanglement and linearity combine to induce decoherence in an open system, causes macroscopic superpositions to be unstable, and therefore these two aspects of quantum mechanics, which appear separately troubling, apparently conspire to produce this phenomenon of decoherence, which I think resolves essentially all of these problematic, certainly all of the problems with macroscopic superpositions. Now, this little fellow here is kind of got a Mona Lisa's half smile. There is still a debate out there about whether decoherence theory resolves all of the problems of the interpretation of quantum mechanics, the measurement problem, and so on. I'm inclined to think that it does. People like Zurek and Zay have been writing articles about this for 20 or 30 years now. But there is still debate out there in the literature. About 10 years ago, Zurek wrote a Physics Today article which produced a whole flood of letters about it, complaining that decoherence really doesn't solve the fundamental problems of quantum mechanics. So it's kind of still under debate. Some people still dispute that decoherence is as important as some people claim. I'm not sure I completely made up my mind, but I kind of think decoherence certainly has a shot at resolving all of these difficulties. Okay. Let me now I'm going to talk about very elementary things, so apologies to the people who know this stuff well. Let me now introduce the reduced density matrix. So consider the universe, and we postulate that the universe is a Hilbert space and that quantum mechanics applies to the universe. And for whatever reason, we're going to consider a finite subsystem of the universe, which I'll simply call the system, described by Hilbert space H-cis, and the rest of the universe I'm going to generically call an environment, and that has its own Hilbert space. The Hilbert spaces will be spanned by these two basis vectors, basis sets, labeled N for system, alpha for environment. And we postulate that the universe as a whole can be described by a state vector in the Hilbert space of the universe, and this can be written in general as an arbitrary linear combination of tensor products of the basis states for the system and the environment with some sort of coefficients. So we just postulate that. Now, in quantum mechanics, the state of a system is given by a state vector, but it is equivalently given by a density operator. Let me introduce rho hat, which is a bra and a ket facing each other like that. It's an operator, and it can be decomposed in this way into the basis states. And this is the density operator. It also describes the state of the universe. Or if we know we're going to be working in this particular basis all the time, we can instead just talk about these coefficients, these numerical coefficients, and that, of course, is the density matrix in that particular basis. Okay, so far it's out, you know, it's up to us whether we use state vectors to describe the state of a system or the density operator. However, you don't have a choice when you consider an open system. So to begin discussing that, let me first talk about an observable given by some operator A hat, which is an observable for the system only. So this is something that cares about only properties of the system and not of the environment. For example, it might be, if your system is an electron, it might be the spin state of the electron. Okay. So A hat acts only on the system Hilbert space, not on the environment Hilbert space. So suppose we want to compute the expectation value of this operator. So there it is. And we can just rewrite this as the trace over the Hilbert space of the whole universe, of the density operator of the universe and the operator A hat. And then we can expand, we can write this out explicitly, this trace out explicitly like that. And because, by hypothesis, this operator here is a system observable only, it doesn't act on the environment Hilbert space, we get A hat sandwiched between basis states for the system only, and the environment basis states just form this inner product. And from orthogonality, these summations collapse to give you this one. And an object appears here in the middle. Well, let's look at this line. What have we got? First of all, we've got the matrix elements with respect to the system basis of our observable. Secondly, we have this thing in brackets. And this is this is something one can derive from the density matrix of the whole universe. And you see that what is happening here is there is a summation or a trace being done over the states of the basis states of the environment. So what we now do is take this thing in brackets here and call it rho cis. And this is the density matrix for, and this is what is termed the reduced density matrix for the system. It is something you get from the density matrix of the whole universe by tracing over the environment states. And the point is that this expression can be just written as a trace over the system basis states of the system density matrix or the reduced density matrix times the system observable A hat. So in order to compute this expectation value, you don't actually need to know the density operator of the whole universe. It suffices to know this reduced density operator for the system itself. And therefore, if you're talking about open quantum systems, this is the object that you need to know, and you're not worried about what the rest of the universe is doing. It's too complicated. It's a thermal bath. You can't follow all of the degrees of freedom. So rather than talking about this very impractical object, the density operator of the whole universe, instead we can talk about this reduced density operator for the system and compute expectation values using it.
How easy is it to figure out how it embeds the information about what the rest of the universe is? It somehow reflects it. That's something.
Yeah. Well, so let me go on with the story, and I think implicitly I'll, if not answer that, at least say something more about it. Okay, so let us define this thing, rho cis, trace over the environment of the density operator of the universe, and we call this the reduced density matrix, and that encodes the state of the system. So it's not the state of the universe, just the state of the system. And this is the object we're kind of obliged to use if we're talking about the quantum mechanics of open systems. All right, so we know how to describe the states of an open system. Now let's talk about the time evolution of that state. Okay, so we postulate once again that the universe as a whole obeys some dirty big Schrodinger equation. So this is the state vector of the universe, is some Hamiltonian for the universe, and time evolution is obtained by solving the Schrodinger equation. Equivalently, if we want to use density operators instead of state vectors, then we have to solve this von Neumann equation. It's all, either way, we just have unitary evolution. And so we postulate that the universe as a whole is just undergoing unitary evolution, nothing more than that. However, since we cannot follow the state of the universe as a whole, and we can only follow subsystems, or what I'm calling purely a system, what we really are interested in is not so much this thing, which we can never compute, but the time evolution of the reduced density matrix rho cis. And this problem, what is the time evolution of the reduced density matrix, can be a very, very complicated problem indeed. However, under some interesting circumstances, it is possible to derive something called a master equation. And this master equation is a first order differential equation in time for the reduced density matrix, and it has generically two terms on the right hand side. One is the von Neumann term. This is, so what appears here is the Hamiltonian for the system. I'll talk more about what this is later on, but it's just the Hamiltonian for the system, so ignoring the bits of the Hamiltonian that pertain to the environment. And this is commuted with the reduced density operator, and if you had just this term alone, if you forgot about that, then we would just have unitary evolution for the system. So this is if we were considering an isolated system. However, because the system is not in general isolated, there's another term on the right-hand side, and this induces non-unitary evolution in general. This is under the circumstances that a master equation can be derived. This term is given by the system, can be deduced from the form of the system-environment couplings. And the capital L here, I that's in honor of a guy called Lindblad, who looked at the general form such a term should take. Now, I'm not going to be talking here about deriving master equations. Actually, that's Ray Sawyer's territory, so I'll defer to him on that issue.
Can you say a few more words about L so I can hang on to something?
Yeah.
Are there some words that I can hang on to?
Yeah, I'll show some examples. So first of all, I just want to quote from one of the pioneers of this field, Dieter Zey. This is a poetic quote. Oops. I just like the quote. So he says, every time dependence of a density matrix rho, density matrix of the universe rho, for example, according to a von Neumann equation, induces a time dependence of its coarse-grained projection, and by that he means just the reduced density matrix, coarse-grained projection, similar to the motion of a shadow that merely reflects the motion of its source. So it's like when you consider the time evolution of the reduced density matrix, you're not worried about what all the other degrees of freedom are doing in the universe, and so what you're really seeing is a kind of a shadow. And in another piece, he called this shadows on the walls of Plato's cave. And I'll return to the subject of Plato, unfortunately, in a second. Okay, now let me introduce decoherence. Very, very simple and pedagogical. So consider a two-state system, and I'm going to consider an idiotic kind of environment, a two-state environment. So let's call the system basis states up and down, and let's call the environment basis states 1 and 2. So of course, usually environments are thermal baths, something very complicated, a lot of degrees of freedom, but for the point I want to make, let me just take a two-dimensional environment. So let me consider a pure state, a state vector for the system, and let me make it completely general, some arbitrary coherent superposition of up and down. We can turn this into a density operator and then a density matrix with respect to this basis, and you get a nice 2x2 matrix. The diagonal entries just are the probabilities of finding the system in spin up or spin down, and the off-diagonal entries will play a crucial role in the rest of this discussion. They encode the coherence information to do with this state. They encode the fact that this is a coherent superposition of spin up and spin down. And they are given by these products of the two expansion coefficients, which contain the phase coherence information of this state. And one way to define decoherence is just the circumstance where the magnitude of these off-diagonal entries, the coherences, are less than what they would be were the system to be in a pure state, that is to say, described by a state vector. So the extreme case is where the off-diagonal entries completely vanish. And in this case, we just have the probabilities of spin up and spin down, and we just have a statistical mixture of spin up and spin down. There is no sense in which the individual particles in the ensemble are in coherent superpositions of up and down. You just have in your mixture, you just have a bunch of particles that are spin up and another bunch of particles that are spin down. That's it, but there's no superposition of spin up and spin down. So that's the extreme, completely incoherent mixture case. So how can such a situation arise? Well, it arises through entanglement with an environment, another quantum system. So suppose that at an initial time, we take our state for the system, and suppose the environment is in some kind of arbitrary state, let's call it one. And let's suppose at this point the system and the environment are not entangled, which means the state of the whole universe is just a tensor product of the state of the system and the state of the environment. Now, unitary evolution can induce the following change in the state of the system plus the environment. It can entangle up and down with environment states 1 and 2, like this. And in this trivial example, I'm assuming that these expansion coefficients don't change. In general, they will, but let's suppose they don't. Doesn't matter. So, and this change here can be induced purely by unitary evolution. The interesting thing is the following, that if you compute the reduced density matrix of the system from this initial unentangled state vector, you get this. And this is just telling you that the state of the system is a pure state, and it's described by a density matrix which is completely equivalent to a state vector. However, after this entanglement dynamics which induces entanglement has happened, when you trace over the environment basis and you compute the reduced density matrix, in the circumstance that states 1 and 2 are completely orthogonal to each other, the off-diagonal elements disappear, and you've induced complete decoherence, turned a pure state into a completely mixed state. And
let's see, in this little example that you gave, you have to show that the black arrow is indeed unitary.
Yeah, and it is.
Yeah. You do have an explicit, it's not unitary. Well, what about that line on top?
It's not unitary, Jim?
No, this is a measurement, right?
People
have used this for
From which line is the
butter? I want that line.
Yeah, that's unitary. Yeah. You worried me greatly for a second.
But people have used this for a measurement. So say one is a measuring device.
Yeah, I'll talk about that in a second, okay?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's all right.
Well, this is how people started thinking about this.
Yeah.
But in this form, it's a little confusing. Why you used up and down?
Well, just to call it something.
I understand, but that density matrix and the up and down would be the same as the density matrix horizontally.
Up
and down.
Okay, so it's true. One has a basis choice that one can make in writing this matrix. That's true. So I've chosen to work with respect to a particular basis, and with respect to that basis, you see complete decoherence. Anyway, in words, one says here that the quantum correlations, which exist between up and down, get diffused through the environment through this entanglement procedure. And when you form the reduced density matrix for the system, apparently the quantum correlations go away. You no longer.
And the density matrix for the whole universe would presumably reflect that the system is in a pure state.
The system plus environment is in a pure state,
yes,
remains
exactly.
In a pure state.
That's what
Yeah. Exactly.
The universe,
our four-dimensional universe. Different four dimensions, of course. Okay, let me now talk a little bit about measurement. Again, by way of review or perhaps introduction to those of you who don't follow this. Let me now present what I think is becoming a canonical view of what the measurement process must entail. So this time we have to introduce a third element called the apparatus. And again, one keeps with our hypothesis that quantum mechanics applies to absolutely everything. The entire universe, the system, must also apply to the apparatus. The apparatus is just another quantum system. Well, not just, but it is a quantum system. And so one now has this tripartite division of the world, environment, system, and apparatus. And we'll see why this is, I think, necessary. So again, let's look at the following situation. Suppose initially the system is in some coherent superposition of up and down. The apparatus is in some state. I'm just labeling it A up. It's just some state. And the environment is in some sort of a state, E up. This up is just a label. And let's just suppose that the initial state is completely unentangled amongst these three elements. Now, let us suppose that the system and the apparatus have an interaction Hamiltonian, which couples them together, and that induces unitary evolution, which now entangles, just as before, the state of the system with two different states of the apparatus, which I'll call A up and A down. And this is a getting towards a, being a measurement-like process, because when you do a measurement, what you want to do is correlate a property of the system that you're doing the measurement on with a pointer reading, some reading on an apparatus. And here one is correlating the state of the system up with the apparatus state A up, and similarly down with A down. At this point, I'm just supposing, in this kind of schematic example, that the environment remains unentangled with these two other elements. Now, one can then ask the question, is this a quantum mechanical description of a measurement, or is it not? And the argument that's presented in the decoherence literature is that this is, in fact, not yet a measurement. And let me tell you the reason. And in fact, Zurek calls this a pre-measurement. And I guess he would have discussed this during the quantum information workshop here a year or so ago. Now, the third element, the environment, comes in if we now say that inevitably this system and this apparatus are going to interact with an environment and they're going to become entangled with it. So now let's suppose that further unitary evolution using an interaction Hamiltonian that couples system and apparatus, or one or the other, to the environment also operates and now entangles E with A and the system. If you now compute the reduced density matrix for the system plus apparatus, so not for the system, now combine these two things in a bigger quantum system, system plus apparatus, so compute the density, reduced density matrix of that by tracing out the environment. And by tracing out the environment means you just sum over all of the basis states, and in the circumstance, once again, that these two environment states are orthogonal, what that produces for you is a reduced density matrix that is just an incoherent mixture of these different system times apparatus correlated states. So I ask you to compare this correlation between the system and the apparatus and this correlation between the system and the apparatus. And the difference between them is that this is a coherent quantum mechanical superposition of the different possible outcomes of the measurement, whereas this is an incoherent mixture of the different possible outcomes of the measurement. There are no off-diagonal terms. If one were to turn this into a density matrix, it would just have the two diagonal entries, the probabilities, and no coherences. So the quantal correlations between the different possible outcomes of the measurement have been diffused through the environment, through this entanglement process, and traced out. And the argument is that this is a genuine measurement because it's an incoherent mixture of the possible outcomes, whereas this is not, because you still have coherent superposition of the different outcomes, which is not what we see when we do an experiment. So you, as a conscious entity, are meant to put yourself in this Hilbert space. You are part of the apparatus, and so what you see when you do a measurement is a definite outcome. And that's because you have been decohered from all of the other possible outcomes, if you like.
Now, Ray, I'm confused about this kind of stuff all the time. And if I were to consider system and apparatus together as my system, then this would just reduce to the previous transparency, right?
Yeah. So it depends what it is, what degrees of freedom, what system, what system, what it depends what you have control over. So if you are able to, so in this case we're supposing that, well, I don't know, put yourself here. So you can know about the state of the system and the state of the apparatus, but the environment is so overwhelmingly large that you have no way.
I don't understand the phrase "put yourself here."
Okay, so.
Then that's like
the hypothesis is that, you know, we human beings. I don't want to really get into this. Oh. I'm not sure.
Consciousness.
No, I don't want to talk about that. But we are also quantum systems. But we are ourselves subsystems of the universe. So we don't have this godlike perspective where we can see the state vector of the entire universe. So we are obliged to consider ourselves like one of these. So that's what I said. If you like, attach yourself to as being part of the apparatus, and when these different outcomes happen, this is you observing that the system is in spin up. This contains the state of you observing that the system is spin down, and those two different states of memory, records in your mind or whatever, decohere from each other through further entanglement with.
I don't see why you just can't make it all apparatus. Why does the environment and the apparatus have to be separated?
Because then you are left with this situation, and you have a coherent superposition of the different outcomes, rather than in any sense having the different outcomes appear as separate, you know, as separate outcomes. You have superpositions of them, not mixtures of them. And the hypothesis is that to really produce a measurement outcome, you need incoherent mixtures of the possibilities, not a superposition.
He wants to talk about the correlations between the system and the apparatus. When the spin is up, the apparatus are just about.
Yep.
And the down goes down. And it goes, the probabilities which express those correlations.
Okay, so the outcomes are not superposed. That's the.
But the apparatus chooses a basis.
The environment. Well.
Basis.
Okay. There's now a long discussion about basis choice and so on, and one has to discuss what Zurek calls Ein selection, and maybe Jim calls it something else. But this is where the environment, where you look at the interactions between, you know, your system, your apparatus with an environment, and you ask what are the stable states, what are the states of the system that persist despite the coupling with the environment, whereas there will be other states, macroscopic superpositions, for example, which do not persist in the face of interactions with the environment, and then it's those particular persistent states, the ones that can survive assault by an environment, which you then latch onto as classical states for a start, and you know, also the states that are the outcomes of measurements. Okay, I mean there's a huge literature on this, and I guess we can't pause to go through all that.
I think there's a simple way of looking at it.
Yep.
If you imagine that this apparatus had some Geiger counter in it, which determined which type of measurement it carried out, east, west, or up, down, then you just had more branches, right, of which. Where the Geiger counter went one way, he measured it up, there was a correlation with the spin being up, and when it went down, and measured east-west, and there was a correlation with east-west. They'd all be on different orthogonal branches. He would multiply his little matrix by two. So it doesn't.
Yep. Okay, now just for your amusement or your irritation, I'm not sure which, I'll show you the following. Max Tegmark put a paper on the web the other day, and I think there'll be another one soon on a completely different topic. But this one was on parallel universes, and one of the possible parallel universe structures one can consider are these decohered branches. And he tells the fable of the bird and the frog, and I kind of like this, so I'll burden you with it for a few minutes. So he says, when discussing parallel universes, in this case Jim's decohering branches, we need to distinguish two different ways of viewing a physical theory. The outside view, or the bird perspective, so this is this godlike creature that can see the state vector of the whole universe, bird perspective of a mathematician, okay, so they're godlike, studying its mathematical fundamental equations, and the inside view, or the frog perspective, so this is a little creature that sits in the bottom of a pond and, you know, can't see the whole universe, but, you know, knows a little bit about him or herself. The frog perspective of an observer living in the world described by the equations. From the bird perspective, the level 3 multiverse, this is just the wave function, is simple. There is only one wave function, and it evolves smoothly and deterministically over time without any sort of splitting or parallelism. The abstract quantum world described by this evolving wave function contains within it, however, a vast number of parallel classical storylines which correlate with Jim's branches, continuously splitting and merging, as well as a number of quantum phenomena that lack a classical description. From her frog perspective, however, each observer perceives only a tiny fraction of this full reality. So, you know, you can't claim that you can access the quantum state of the whole universe, so you're obliged to consider yourself as one of these subsystems and consider yourself as an apparatus, as I would say, I think. She cannot see only her own Hubble volume, and decoherence prevents her from perceiving all of the other parallel copies of herself. I don't want to get too much into this, but I think this bird and frog perspective I found rather charming. I threatened to bring Plato back into it. So just again for your amusement, he divides these two perspectives into Aristotelian and Platonic. So the Platonic is the bird perspective. There's this ideal object, the state vector of the universe, which is kind of there, but you don't have access to it. And instead we have to behave as if we're Aristotelian creatures like frogs, and we can only perceive a small portion of the overall reality.
What is that
flow chart? Oh, I didn't even look at that.
You're going to give the neutrino perspective?
Okay, let me say just a few words about decoherence and the quantum to classical transition. So let's consider the Hamiltonian of the world. It contains a bit that acts only on the system Hilbert space, term that acts on the environment Hilbert space, and one which couples the two things together. And from that, we want to derive a master equation. So this system-environment coupling Hamiltonian is what induces this Lindblad or non-unitary term in the master equation. And as Lincoln taught us many years ago, the system-environment coupling can also affect what we take as a system Hamiltonian through a refractive index, for example. So it's another thing, but what I'll be primarily concerned with here is this arrow. So I just want to present an old model described by Zurek in this Physics Today article in 91 and looked at by various people, Caldera and Leggett famously. So the system is a particle moving in one dimension, and the environment is a bunch of oscillators as bundled together as a scalar field. System-environment coupling is just the position observable for the particle and phi dot. And from that, one can churn away and compute a master equation for the reduced density matrix of the system. And this is what you get. So this is the von Neumann term, inducing unitary evolution, depends on the system Hamiltonian only. And these things here are proportional to epsilon. I think this is, there's some error here. I can't remember, I think there's an epsilon squared. There's an epsilon squared. These two terms are driven by this system-environment coupling. This is a relaxation term, but this is the one of interest. It's a decoherence. It induces decoherence. Yeah.
Now, this term that you introduced, the system-environment, the valid primary pursuit, is that right?
Sure.
I in front of the epsilon.
Sure.
Epsilon's real, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, right, it's not me, it's...
But is that allowed? I mean...
Yeah, I guess so.
So can you, for the sake of discussion, say that, let's say, time reversal is a very small effect in the case of the Bayesian system? Would you still get...
Yeah.
The same?
Well, for this particular case, I don't know. I don't do calculations in the system. I'm presenting other people's work. But I'll talk about the neutrino case a little bit more, where the microscopic interactions are definitely time reversible. Anyhow, this is the important term for us. It's a decoherence term. Notice a few things about it. There's a minus sign, and all the rest of the coefficient here of the density matrix is, should be rho cis, is positive definite. So there's a bunch of numbers. And then there's an x minus x prime squared. Now, this density matrix here is in position space. So think of x and x prime as the rows and the columns of the big density matrix. So when x equals x prime, we are talking about the diagonal entries, the probability densities in this case, whereas when x is different from x prime, we are accessing the quantile correlations between different parts of the wave function. And the point is that this term exponentially damps, because of this minus sign, the off-diagonal entries of this density matrix in position space. And that's why this is a decoherence-inducing term.
I could just make a remark about Tony's question. I mean, the original equations, of course, time-reversed and invariant, but to derive this particular one, they make an assumption that the bath really was going to be huge, and, so they're essentially introducing the irreducibility, same way you introduce it to statistical mechanics. And that's why.
Okay. Okay. Thanks. Okay, so then this model was applied to, I'll just present what Zurich presented in this 1991 article. So consider a coherent superposition of two Gaussian wave packets peaked at different positions. And let's just evolve that in time using that master equation and see what happens. So initially, here is the density matrix, x and x prime. So initially, all of the entries, diagonal and off-diagonal, are equally large. And then when one lets the master equation run and these decohering interactions happen, the off-diagonal entries are exponentially reduced in size. And one is left with an incoherent mixture of particle that's definitely located around this position in space, and or definitely located in this other position, but not a superposition of the two. And if you play around with the timescales in the problem, you can make the following remark. Again, I'm just quoting this article. If you take the ratio of the decoherence to the relaxation timescales here, it is inversely, well, it depends on a number of things, in particular inversely on the separation of the peaks of the two Gaussians, so 1 over delta x squared. And if you put in typical macroscopic numbers, so suppose you wanted to create macroscopic superposition of a 1 gram mass particle separated by 1 centimeter, and you have two Gaussians which are peaked 1 centimeter apart, you have a coherent superposition of them, ask, in the face of this quantum Brownian motion, how quickly is that superposition decohered relative to other timescales in the problem? And you get this enormously small number, 10 to the minus 40. And this is meant to illustrate that decoherence happens extremely quickly. But if you have anything that smells like a macroscopic superposition, if there's an environmental interaction, it'll be just decohered like that. So CAT states are very unstable. And of course, this is the problem in quantum computer technology. If you want to use unitary evolution to do a computation, you better maintain quantum coherence. Otherwise, you've got yourself a classical computer. So this timescale ratio is a real problem for them. And this is one of the reasons that the maintenance of quantum coherence in a system when it is interacting with an environment is an important issue. Okay. There are not many neutrinos yet. Let me now quickly review the quantum Zeno effect. So again, system-environment coupling. Let me now specialize to the case where the system-environment coupling factorizes into an operator that acts only on system Hilbert space, and the other one that V, which acts on the environment. Let the system be two-dimensional, call it up and down, left and right, or two neutrino flavors, nu alpha and nu beta. The zeta is a 2x2 Hermitian matrix. For the purposes of this talk, I will consider diagonal matrices only, 1 plus B, 1 minus B. There's a parameter B in the problem, which tells us about what system environment coupling we've got. specifies the strength of the coupling of the environment to each of the system basis states. So if B is different from zero, the environment couples with different strength to the two different basis states in the system. For example, if you have an active and a sterile neutrino in superposition in the early universe or dense supernova environment, then of course the active neutrino part of the superposition will be colliding with the background medium, whereas the sterile part will not. And in that case, you should put B equal to 1 or minus 1. So the environment in that case couples to one of these states and not the other. That's the active-sterile story. And if you have active-active neutrino oscillations or superpositions, then both of them need to be non-zero. So let me say some of this again. So as I said, two extreme cases where one of the basis states does not couple to the environment, like active sterile. In the neutrino literature, this was looked at first by Stadolsky and Dolgov very early on in the early 80s, and then it was a very active area of research. Around 1990, Enquist and Kainalainen and the Finnish crowd got involved, and then we got involved in the mid-90s, and I guess it was an active area of research for about 5 or 6 years from the mid-90s. If B is equal to, so this active sterile kind of situation arises when this parameter B is 1 or minus 1. The opposite extreme is when B is 0. In that case, zeta is just the identity matrix. And in this case, the environment couples equally to the two basis states. If you want a neutrino example, if you have a new mu, new tau coherent superposition in nuclear matter, so just nucleons, as you would get, for example, in a proto-neutron star, then just neutral current interactions, and they couple equally strongly to new mu and new tau, and that is kind of like this situation where zeta is the identity matrix. And this is the circumstance that Nicole Ray and I looked at in our PRA paper, which I hope to get to. Okay, one can compute a master equation in this case, and the Lindblad term, the decoherence term, takes this familiar double commutator form. So we have the reduced density matrix of the system here commuted with this zeta matrix and then commuted again. The coefficient out the front has a minus sign and it has a gamma, and the gamma is the system environment interaction rate, and that can be computed from V. Now, okay. So that's the form of the master equation. And you see this double commutator form all over the place in the literature, quantum optics in particular. Let's have a closer look at it. If you actually put the matrix in and do two lines of algebra, you see that this term has the following structure. So it doesn't affect the diagonal entries at all, but it affects the off-diagonal entries. So provided B is, and it's overall proportional to B squared, so for any B that's different from zero, this system environment term is trying to exponentially damp the coherences, the off-diagonal entries in the density matrix, and this is decoherence. So this is another model for system environment interactions and decoherence, and you can correlate this with what I reviewed from the Zurek article. Okay, now let me turn to the quantum Zeno effect. So let's have a look at the differential equations for rho 1-1 and rho 2-2, the probabilities. These couple to the coherences. So if the coherences are exponentially damped to zero by a huge decoherence term, then the right-hand sides here go to zero, and rho 1-1 dot and rho 2-2 dot are zero, and the probabilities are frozen in this limit when this coupling here, gamma, is very, very large, and this decoherence happens very, very quickly. In the circumstance where the initial state was that the system was either in the one eigenstate or the two eigenstate, then in this limit what happens is that it just stays in that eigenstate forever. All evolution is frozen, it's just kept in that same state by the system environment decohering interactions, and this is what I will call the quantum Zeno effect. And this is what would happen for active sterile oscillations in the early universe. the temperature is high, the collision rate is really, really, really high. And if your neutrinos begin as active neutrinos, then they would stay as active neutrinos until the collision started to die down a little bit, and it could evolve away from this situation.
I'm confused. This is only for gamma and standard?
Yeah.
What's gamma again?
Gamma is the rate of interaction between. So it would be a collision rate if we were talking about neutrinos in the early universe.
Okay. But this is different from what was originally called the quantum zero.
Oh, okay. So
it's a quantum zero effect number two.
Let me come to that.
Well, it's actually related, I guess, because the environment is effectively a measure.
Yeah. Okay, so let me now address that. So there's an apparent similarity of this this situation to measurement. When gamma goes to infinity, this is like you are measuring this flavor observable, let's call it flavor, all the time. Just keep measuring it. And so if you were to not like decoherence and instead you wanted to go back to the collapse postulate, the Copenhagen interpretation, all that stuff, then you go back to the measurement postulate, which says you start off with a superposition of eigenstates and you do a measurement of that observable, you collapse the thing into an eigenstate. If you were then to do repeated measurements of that same observable over and over and over again, then you would keep collapsing it back to that same eigenstate because it would never get a chance to evolve out. So this was the original Mishra and Sudarshan kind of quantum Zeno effect. I don't actually want to, I mean, I don't like the collapse postulate at all. I don't think it's relevant. And so I'm quite prepared to just call this environmentally induced freezing as the quantum Zeno effect. Now,
are you going to say something about what this freezing has to do with the phenomenology?
Well,
I'm sure that's probably obvious to anybody else here.
Yeah. I mean, that's a whole talk in itself. When if sterile neutrinos exist, then we have exactly this B equals plus or minus one situation. And at high temperatures, the collisions are rapid, gamma is large, and the neutrino is frozen, for example, into the active eigenstate. So suppose you set up the circumstance where there are no sterile neutrinos in the universe, just have the active neutrinos. The collisions keep the thing in that active eigenstate. But as the temperature of the universe goes down, the collisions go down in rapidity, and so eventually this freezing, there's a thaw, and eventually the sterile neutrino states can be populated. And so in the early universe, what you need to compute is, you know, how quickly that happens, whether it's a problem phenomenologically for Big Bang nuclear synthesis and so on. And there's a significant body of work on that.
So the sterile neutrinos might, what would they do to Big Bang nuclear synthesis? Not keep them open because they're sterile, but the expansion here.
Exactly.
It sounds like the details of till when does the freezing last influences the degree to which early universe information does or does not tell us anything about sterile neutrinos.
Absolutely. So, for example, if the delta M squareds between active and sterile neutrinos are really, really small, then the decoherence would be maintained. The freezing would be maintained effectively for far longer than if they were large. Yes. Okay. Now, heuristically, so this pertains when B is different from zero. So remember that the matrix was 1 plus b, 1 minus b, 0, 0. This was zeta. So if b is different from 0, the environment, if you like, can tell the difference between the two basis states in the system. And so it can, if you like, perform a measurement of them. It can tell, distinguish them. And that's when you get this freezing. And when gamma goes to infinity, this is constant monitoring of the system by the environment, as one might say. However, in the other circumstance, when B is zero, zeta is the identity, and a double commutator term just trivially vanishes. The environment apparently has no effect on the system, and the system evolution is completely unitary, decoherence-free. So this is the other circumstance where the coupling to the environment is equally strong for the two basis states. So apparently, in that case, nothing happens. However, yeah, for example, yeah.
So if I know, yes, we do have one, then B is equal to 1.
Yeah.
B equals 0 is like
mu and tau neutrinos.
Yeah, yeah, it's like mu and
different.
Yeah. So if you have mu and tau neutrinos in a nucleon bath,
yeah,
that's like B equals zero. You know, electron, positron, plasma, I know we don't have such a thing in the early universe, but... So, I mean, Ray and I, we're struggling to find a neutrino situation where this was really, really important, that you could get these flavor-blind collisions, as we called them. And the problem with... Well, I won't delay things too much because I'm really going over time here.
Could you say which way you get more helium or less helium? Because the observations are helium.
You get more helium.
Well, really, I think that's good. There's some discrepancy between the observations and
helium. Yeah, but a little bit more helium is good, but too much more helium is not good.
Yeah.
So. Okay. Time to unbind Zeno.
Yeah.
So when zeta is the identity, in the case I presented earlier, you don't get any effect. However, this circumstance can give really non-trivial effects, an interesting effect, in a rather well-motivated generalization of the previous case, which considered just a two-state system. So let's go back to neutrinos. Neutrinos have not only flavor, but they have energy. And when they collide with particles in the early universe, their energy changes. So you need to add another label to your state vector. So previously, we just had the label alpha, 1 and 2. Mu and tau, E and S, whatever it was. But we must also talk about the energies of these states. And so now let me consider this generalized situation where there are energy-changing processes happening. Terminology introduced by Ray is, we'll call these flavor labels in the neutrino situation a horizontal coordinate, and the energy labels a vertical coordinate. And collisions change energy. Here, let me give actually the system that we focus on in the PRA article. It's not neutrinos, but it's just a symmetrical double well, one-dimensional, kind of a undergraduate quantum mechanics situation. And so we consider different energy levels in the bound part of the spectrum. We have a left and a right well, and we have tunneling between left and right. And we consider the case where, the configuration of this turns the energy levels into nearly degenerate pairs. We have a symmetric double well, so we get nearly degenerate pairs here, here, and here. And we then couple this double well system to a thermal bath, which can move particles amongst these different energy levels. So we have the ground state, which is nearly degenerate pair. That nearly degenerate pair will correspond to this alpha equals 1 and 2. And then we have this vertical structure, which is why it's called vertical structure, of these well-separated energy levels and the excited states. And the bath, we're going to consider bath-induced single well transitions that can take you up and down amongst these different energy levels. So this is a more complex situation than the one I had before, which effectively omitted these excited states. And in this case, this kind of flavor-blind coupling can gives non-trivial effects and interesting effects. So first thing is one has to deal with a more complicated master equation, which takes into account the energy-changing processes. The analog of this has been derived in the kinetic theory of neutrino literature, McKellar and Thomson, Siegel, Raffelt, and Sadolsky, and so on. So this is like the previous master equation. Here is the von Neumann term, and here are scattering terms. Here is the zeta matrix, here is the rho, and here are gammas. And these are bath-induced rates for transitions amongst these vertical states, these different energy levels. And we have forward and backwards, which are related by a thermal factor. And Ray is actually the guy who derived this in this context, and you can see his derivation in the appendix of our paper. So first term is unitary evolution. The second and third terms are just scattering in and out of the energy level EI. And when you put zeta equal to 1 here, the non-unitary terms do not vanish. So some notes about this master equation. It reduces to the double commutator form in the absence of vertical structure. When zeta is 1, the case is now non-trivial. We don't have to consider superpositions of different energy states. I don't want to talk about that. Now let me just present some results. So we took our double well system. We kind of coarse-grained it, so we considered left and right rather than the full spatial structure of the double well. So let's consider effectively left and right eigenstates, so we get back to a genuinely two-state horizontal coordinate. We choose this thing as our Hamiltonian, so it's got energies along the diagonal, and it has some small off-diagonal terms which model the tunneling through the barrier and the left-right oscillations. So now these left-right oscillations between the two sides of the well become our metaphor for neutrino oscillations, if you like. Okay? Oh, and I should
say, with the oscillation times depending on energy, just
yeah,
as neutrino transformation times depend on neutrino energy.
Thank you. I realized I had omitted to say that. So these tunneling rates can be computed from undergraduate quantum mechanics, and they give energy-dependent tunneling rates. And we model this with a sigma 1 matrix in our coarse-grained left-right description. Okay, so the effect of this Hamiltonian, if there were no system Barth couplings, is that particles in the different excited states of the double well would just oscillate backwards and forwards, left to right, with different frequencies computed from this function, which one can figure out. So I'm not considering electromagnetic de-excitations or anything like that either. Okay, so as I said, for the neutrino case, this was looked at by a bunch of people. It's been generalized to Fermi statistics, and it also includes neutrino, anti-neutrino annihilation. So the equations you'll see in Raffelt and Siegel and McKellar and Thompson are more complicated even than the one I just showed. So in the neutrino context, these things have been derived, but they haven't been used very much or at all. The terms just get very, very, very complicated in the active-active case. In the active sterile case, things collapse and you're left with an equation that's of optical block form, if you know NMR at all. But for active-active oscillations, you get a very god-awful complicated equation, which has been written down by a couple of people but hasn't ever been solved except for special cases. And one of these special cases is the one I'm focusing on here, flavor-blind collisions. The active-active story, well, Yvonne talked about that. I won't go through that. But in the analysis of these papers, collisions are either neglected in these two papers, or in the Dolgov paper, they're put in a very ad hoc way. The full richness of these collision terms for active-active oscillations are not in this paper. It's too complicated to do that, even numerically at the moment. No one has tried. Instead, they mock up the collisions by putting in a simpler term. So it's kind of unfinished business. I mean, one has to think a little bit about whether it's worth going through the effort of doing that. But let me just say that it is unfinished business. Okay, now let me just finish with some results. I just want to now show a bunch of graphs for our double well situation. Okay, so we observed that when you ran that master equation with zeta equal to 1, flavor-blind collisions in the neutrino metaphor, an interesting thing happened. Okay, so what have we got? We have our double well. With our energy levels. And let's put a bunch of particles initially in the left-hand well, and let's just thermally distribute them amongst the different energy levels. So that's our initial state. And then we ask, what is the probability, what fraction, and then we let the thing evolve in time, for different values of the system Barth coupling. And we then ask, what is the probability of finding all of the electrons in the left-hand well at later times? And this is the result. So there's a parameter Q for these different curves, which is a measure of the system Barth interaction rate. So it's just the ratio of the thermal average of the collision rate, if you like, to the free oscillation rate. So when Q goes to infinity, that's when the system bath interaction rate is much, much greater than the oscillation rate. So the system bath interactions, which are moving the thing up and down in the energy levels, are occurring very quickly compared to the oscillation between left and right. Okay, so what we observe is the following. When Q is small, 0.001, what you get is just as complicated superposition of sinusoids of different frequencies. We have different frequencies which are given by this energy-dependent barrier tunneling function G. Complicated superposition of sinusoids. Now start switching on the coupling to the bath and vary it from small to large, from 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the 3. The first curve you get, it looks like a modified, bunch of sinusoids. Then when you make the coupling a little bit larger, 10, you start smoothing out the behavior, but you're also damping down the oscillations. And in fact, asymptotically, you are evolving towards a steady state, completely mixed situation, probability of a half, which means half of the particles in the left part of the well, half are in the right. It's just a steady state, completely mixed, decohered situation.
That's for Q.
That's for Q equal to 10.
What are the units of T?
T, arbitrary units. Ray's arbitrary units. This is time.
Well,
yeah. That rays. This is a few oscillation times of the well. Yeah, it's a few oscillation times of the well.
I mean, if that was cosmology or something,
would
that be short
degree of expansion time? You have to look at the situation you've got.
Are neutrinos now back in the early universe?
I thought we were still neutrinos in the early universe.
Well, I jump back and forth between the physical.
I mean, this is a toy model. There's another venue in which you might consider this to maybe be significant for neutrinos, but we can talk about it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The neutrino side of it is interesting, but at the moment I'm dealing with this one-dimensional double well toy model, which maps onto a neutrino situation, but with a lot of simplifications. Anyway, the interesting thing is that when you make the system bath flavor blind coupling, or side blind as we call it here, where the system bath coupling can't tell whether the particle is, it couples equally strongly whether the particle is in the left or in the right hand part of the well. In that circumstance, when the rate gets very large, 1000, one gets nice undamped sinusoidal oscillations of a single frequency. And this is what we have discovered. It's bath-induced synchronization. So the physical picture here is the following. When there's no bath coupling, you have a bunch of free particles which are just oscillating at incommensurate frequencies between left and right, and you get this complicated sinusoidal superposition when you add them all up. Switch on the bath coupling. When the bath coupling is really, really large, and the bath is sending the particles amongst these energy states really, really quickly compared to the slow oscillation between left and right, the particle doesn't know what oscillation frequency it should have. And in fact, it feels all of them. It samples all of them as it's trying to oscillate across. And so therefore, every particle oscillates with the same frequency, and it's a kind of thermal average of all of the individual frequencies corresponding to these different energy levels. And so they're all nicely doing the same thing.
Why doesn't that damp out too?
Okay, well, it doesn't damp out.
Yeah.
You see, heuristically.
What's the coherence for that?
Well, it does.
Let's say that T goes to infinity now.
This is what I call unbound Zeno. It's like Zeno. I mean, if gamma is not exactly infinity, but it's just very large, you're not going to get complete freezing, right? You're just going to get evolution, approximately frozen. So here, if one were to continue this time evolution for much, much longer, yes, you would see a slow. This is not like a phase transition where suddenly there's no damping. You see just very, very slow damping. I'll show a few more graphs which I think will clarify this. Anyhow,
Just to try to make the connection with the neutrinos in this picture, if I start out with mu at t equals 0, then at about 400 on your scale, it's become
mu tau.
And back again. But the energies haven't been interchanged. If I had a new mu of a definite energy, I get a new tau of the same energy.
Well, here you have an ensemble of neutrinos of different energies.
Okay.
If they were free particles, they would oscillate, undergo flavor oscillations at different rates depending on their energy. Now couple it to a flavor blind bar. Each neutrino is through collisions, is changing its energy all the time. So it doesn't know what oscillation frequency it ought to have. And so they all effectively oscillate at the same frequency, which is a thermal average of all of them. Now, after a tortuous process, we discovered that in NMR, an analogous phenomenon is observed, and it's called this horrendous term, motional narrowing.
Motion being the coupling of that.
Motion meaning the left and right. So the idea is that the frequency spectrum of that motion is narrowed to a single frequency. You can compute analytically the frequency in the neutrino, in a kind of a neutrino-related paper, PLB. You can see the derivation of the frequency. I won't present that here. Let me now show you, I think, one more graph, and then I'll probably, I better stop. I think, enlightening to look at the von Neumann entropy. So this is trace of rho log rho. And this is one can define an entropy for a quantum state, and this is the von Neumann entropy. So we sum over all of the different energy or vertical states. And if one has a pure state, then the von Neumann entropy is zero, and it just remains at zero. However, if one has decoherence, then the von Neumann entropy rises. So it's interesting to ask what happens in this situation to the von Neumann entropy as the system Barth coupling is raised in strength. So forget this offset. I don't explain that. That's easy to understand. So just this is the initial value of the entropy. And now let's ask, how does the entropy evolve in time for different values of the system Barth coupling? So this is very, very small. It gets larger. Gets larger again, and then it gets huge. And notice that you see this interesting turnaround. So when the system Barth coupling is small, the von Neumann entropy is approximately constant. Turn on the system Barth coupling, and the von Neumann entropy quickly rises and then asymptotes to 1. And this is the situation where the oscillations are being asymptoted to just an incoherent mixture of 50% on the left and 50% on the right. But then when you pump up the coupling to large values where motional narrowing or Barth-induced synchronization is induced, you then again recover the situation where the von Neumann entropy remains at its initial value, and therefore quantum coherence is seen to be maintained. So this is reflective of the coherent, lovely coherent sinusoidal oscillations that I showed you on the previous graph.
The entropy always goes up.
Looks like it. Yeah.
I mean, couldn't the subsystem start out hotter than the pan?
This is just the entropy of the flavor, just in the geometrical.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. The vertical, this offset is due to the vertical structure.
What if you had a pure state to begin with, and initial entropy was 0? Does that matter at all, or?
Well, this offset is just because...
And it's because you have a thermal ensemble.
Yeah, a thermal distribution of energy.
What if you had a pure state?
Yeah. No, it doesn't matter.
So,
the energy would be immediately thermalized. If you put all the particles in one energy level, for example, then the first thing that would happen is that they would quickly be thermally distributed amongst the levels, so you'd have this offset created. But what we're interested in is the entropy in the horizontal direction, if you like. So, sorry, Lincoln.
Yeah, you have a dimensionless number that tells you when that curve begins decreasing back to nearly flat. And how does that depend upon anything that you put into your toy model?
Yeah, did we ever compute where the turnaround is analytically, or I don't think we did.
Oh, it's like unity.
It's approximately unity.
It's like when the collision rate is the same as the precession rate.
Roughly. But I don't think we ever computed that analytically. It's interesting to do that. Okay, then we did a bunch of other stuff. We looked at putting Fermi statistics in, the effect persists. We looked at the preservation of entanglement. So now start off with two particles which are in an entangled state of left and right. And we observe that in this large Q limit, the entanglement is preserved. I have a bunch of graphs, but since I've gone so far over time, I'll just leave it with those words. Adiabatic inversion, you can play games with that if you're interested. It's in our paper. Okay, let me now conclude. So the study of open quantum system dynamics is, I think, very interesting and very important. Plays a role in a fundamental understanding of quantum mechanics. It's also important in practice for quantum computation and quantum optics and NMR and neutrino oscillations in dense media. If environments couple differently to horizontal states, then they freeze the evolution in the large gamma limit. And this is the quantum Zeno effect. If environments couple identically to the elements of the basis states of the system, then in the same limit, you don't get freezing or something horrendously complicated. Instead, you get something very nice and simple, Bath-induced synchronization or motional narrowing of the oscillations. And this is interesting because it's a preservation of quantum coherence despite a strong system environment coupling. And you can achieve this because of the special property that the environment can't distinguish between the two horizontal states. Thanks.